55 that we had, you know, of that location. And they could be very temporally disparate and not really have much bearing on what they're talking about, other than the fact that it's, and there's the pragmatic of what they had. There's also that maybe we could problematize it and say, well, like, do they, is there like a certain level which they don't care, or is like kind of collapsing of time to give them like Thomas Metcalf kind of arguments about India. But yeah, that's one of the issues that I imagine we would see if we start pulling the images in.
Yeah, which
but
is...
But do you, I mean, do you really want to process the images themselves? Because then you have to go into image recognition, which is completely different in their applications. But a short way would be more to focus on the captions, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think in the case of the journal scans, I don't think image recognition is going to work because of the quality and because of the illustration, like the kind of black and white rendering and the, but we could do, we could do captions plus human identification of certain, you know, based on captions identifying a particular subset or whatever, if we find particular, you know, that illustrations related to fiction, for example, is something we want to focus on. You know, so it's always within the, it would need to be within the, what's a feasible scope for human eyes to do it.
Yeah, I think, I don't know if we need to make the move yet, but perhaps for the last half hour we should talk about what should the scope of this be. I don't want to stop the brainstorming of the different things we need to yet, but then maybe with an eye toward at some point saying, here's where we do take our stand, here's what we're not going to look at, here's what we would look at.
Can I just raise a practical?
Yeah.
I just, like, I was thinking of something, I was like, I don't want to raise my hand and say this, but I want to share this resource or a site. Should we have like a shared doc?
Yeah, definitely.
That we all have access to so that we can dump idea resources in there while we're.
That's a great idea.
Yes, we should.
I don't
Does
know how.
Do you have a whiteboard marker? Do you have your whiteboard markers in your bag?
Yeah.
Maybe you can create the box.
Just a Google Doc or.
Yeah.
Could everyone
like
write on the board the email address associated with a Google account? and by the end of this session,
so
we should have you all added.
Send it to you.
What's that?
Send it digitally to you.
Can I just, I'll start one and then send it to you, and then you have everyone's email? Do it that
I have everyone's work email. That's not necessarily the email.
Oh, I, oh,
identified
right.
But
there.
To, yeah, for, to create a box in Google Drive, it seems that you need a Gmail address.
You can be anonymous.
Yeah,
can be
oh yeah, that's the better way to do it.
Yeah.
Just
you
an
just
anonymous
send
link.
Link.
Okay, and then I'll email it out.
Yeah.
That's
okay.
That's
yeah.
much
Easy?
Better.
Yeah,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay.
Sorry.
Good. Okay. So
I'll
you're gonna start
I'll
one. Email the link to me, and then I'll share it.
Got it.
Okay, that's way better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just a.
No. Please
okay.
Go, please go.
Yeah, Chris. I was just wondering. I'm guessing that the French had probably other journals.
Yes.
So why only this one?
So for us, for me, it was a matter of scope, like picking one that, and also funding. So some of my startup funds went to trying to clean it.
Okay.
So I would like, I'd love to use lots of different journals and compare it to, say, domestic newspapers. My first, very first project when I was a graduate student, I harvested a bunch of newspapers from Le Temps, and there were huge gaps where there was no OCR information. It was really, really bad. There was almost nothing you could do. So my goal for this one was to say, okay, well, if we took one source, could we get it to a level where we can at least say, for this source, these are the sorts of things. But then hearing David say the travelogs, I think actually pulling in some of the Google digitized travelogs might be a lower hanging fruit to provide some sort of other data to cross-check these things against. I mean, there's the pragmatic concern of,
oh, okay.
of what's...
Okay.
But, I mean, that's a useful question of, mm-hmm. of, you know, if we narrow the scope too much, are we missing too much? Do we have to broaden it? If so, I mean, some of this is planning for, you know, to go back to the NEH and say, okay, this is what everyone says we need, so these are the resources we need,
yeah.
right? And so if we do need to actually have some other, like the Tablet Colonial or something, mm-hmm. in addition to the Jean de Voyage, then that's something we could do as an ask.
Okay.
Just follow up on this. So are you also, you mentioned also the encyclopedia. Are you also using this? Or are you
we haven't yet. That was conversations with Katie about having another data set that's available that is purporting to do something similar, right? Describe the whole world to its French readerships, but in a different way, and then have some comparison.
So
we haven't done any prototyping with that yet, but that's something that we're considering, yeah.
This is the encyclopedia from Arthur?
Yeah.
Okay. I feel like they've done a lot of work on like annotations and computational stuff, too.
Yeah. Yeah, and so that would be another one of the lower hanging fruit, because it wouldn't require taking the source. But then that's a whole other issue, right? So if we always deal with, this is why so much has been done with like the Washington and Jefferson papers, because they're available and they're clean. And if we
well,
only
on
ever use those.
On a practical level, just in terms of converting those documents to a text file or, you know, an encoded OCR file, you should really not be working with microfilm if you can avoid it. And if
yeah.
you can't, then you work with their, they have a master negative that's a clean copy. So you should always work with a master negative, and they can actually duplicate their master negatives with a low contrast, because the reason you have so much noise in the images is because of the high contrast. They've turned it into black and white versus grayscale. And actually OCR works better on grayscale text than it does on black and white text, and certainly high contrast text. So you get a lot, I mean, it's not going to be perfect, but
yeah.
you get much higher accuracy rate in your OCR if you're working with from a grayscale image from the master neg.
I think a lot of these early Galica scans were done from acetate microfilms, which
mm-hmm.
also is why they're really bad.
Well, they have a master neg of the acetate,
yeah.
and that can be duped
okay.
down to with a lower contrast. And the master negs have never been run through any machine, so they have no scratches, they have no problems with it's clean film. So, and that comes out of the National Digital Newspaper Project, where they're doing the same thing. NEH funded that, and they're scanning from microfilm, but they're scanning from the master, what's called an A neg or a
yeah.
B neg. Yeah.
So if we were to, this is something that maybe writing into a grant proposal to get the BNF to, because I mean, me as first year junior faculty when I started this, like, I'm not going to get the BNF to do that.
They may have already done it. It just might not be up on Galica because they already have that up there.
Okay.
Yeah, if you go to the source, sometimes they'll have a better quality image. And depending on the aggregators can dump down the file and make it more readable.
Okay.
It's just like Google scans all the books in full color, but they toss out the full color. Except for the images,
mm-hmm.
and that's why you see when you read a book on Google Books, it's all black and white. But they do have the full color scans. So yeah, that's a little technical side of things.
No, this is all the stuff that yeah we need.
But if you're going back to do something else, it'll get you better quality.
Other thoughts on things that we shouldn't ask of the data, things that we should concern ourselves with?
One thing is exactly the period that magazine publications has went from woodblocks, wood engravings, to photography. Until 1890, it was wood engraving.
Mm-hmm.
After that, photography came in. If you need photography, you need to have somebody at the location making photographs.
Mm-hmm.
If you use wood engraving, you just can make that whatever you like. And so in around 1890, 1895, I expect that the technology for illustrations in the journal changes. That will have a major effect on what's on the contents of the illustrations,
mm.
and therefore on the contents of the captions. And it needs to be incorporated, or else you make mistakes there.
And that kind of goes to the sort of the imagined versus the real.
Exactly.
In that transition,
was
very different.
If you talk about
people perceive things,
mm-hmm.
and you want to have a picture of Senegalese or Algerian,
yeah.
then before 1890, he would draw them or draw them based on a photograph, but it would be drawing.
Yeah.
There's an interpretation there. And if after 1890 it was a technology process to make to print a photograph, you couldn't, there was no Photoshop. The photograph was reasonably accurate, but there was a photographer then at the location.
And I know from my own research that a lot of times these images travel, so they'll draw an image of Marniquez, and that image will show up in Charles Mismer's travelogue, and then it'll show up in A History of Martinique, and then it'll show up in the Journal des Voyages, and it shows up in lots of, anytime they need someone who fits that bill, it's that exact same drawing of that same person.
Because it was also very easy to if as soon as the illustration was made, then to make a copy of the illustration, it was a hell of a lot easier to make a new illustration.
Mm-hmm.
So
it'd be interesting if to do an image analysis to find out how many things were duplicated, how many times a certain image appeared,
yeah,
you know, across time, and
yeah,
how often they would reuse things.
And maybe at the French archives in Aix-en-Provence, you could also get some good picture of the place, the people they colonized, I don't know, in Vietnam, Africa, Canada, and so on, just to wait and to avoid any kind of duplication of the same images taken and spread across the globe.
I'm wondering if there's a lag with this journal, in particular, Carol, or this kind of journal, in the sense of the time it took by ship and the temperature conditions and I'm sure there were photographs from that time. I suspect they were much, much rarer, and maybe for publications such as this, they didn't come in until later.
Well, that's probably also why, like, if there's a fire in this colony or that colony, they're like, here's a picture of that city from 10 years ago. Because they probably got the news via telegraph long before any photograph.
And the cutting edge photography comes in like 2 years later after getting held up in whatever port. And
Yeah. So they'll just save it and use it for the next time something happens.
Right.
Here's the photo
or
10 years ago.
Or copy it from a source that is more recent, from newspapers or from. Steal images of copy images from other sources to put into the journal.
Yeah, they did that a lot with maps. You'd see the same map over and over again, but one's clearly just a tracing of the other one.
And frequently reversed because mirrored because it's easy to mirror.
Draw on the back.
So at the time, there was no plagiarism.
You could copy
anything.
Love the word.
But I mean, that has real implications, though, for how if we get into the reception, this kind of reduplication of the same images that are often out of date or seem to be timeless. It's the same picture of the same Martinique every single time something happens, has a real impact on the people reading that journal.
No, I was thinking because it took a while to use photograph in print, and as you said, it was a cheap paper, so it probably not so, because photography was available from 1839, but I think it took a while to be printed correctly, so they keep using photography just to draw over it.
Yeah, I think 1915, 1920 is when you really start to see photographs being reproduced.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah,
mostly they're done as line drawings.
Yes.
Is that
they rotoscope over the photograph and then reproduce that? Is that how they would do it?
Well, he reproduced. Sorry, I don't say it one more time. Just
so would they rotoscope, like draw, like take the photograph and then trace
yeah,
it
and
then print the trace
it?
Yeah. Or, yeah, or yeah, do some kind of line drawing, yeah. But, you know, with the screen printing is what was required to do the reproduction in a print. Well, you'll know more about this, but yeah, from my old printing press days, that, you know, that you had to actually screen the print so that it wouldn't become muddied as a photograph. So, but they did. They continued until probably 1915, 1920 is when you started seeing more reproductions
in U.S.
I'm going by U.S. newspapers, basically.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, there's probably a history of printing person who might know that. But and just one other, which is a quick note, but you know, you might, if you decide to do something with the images, you could also just reach out to the BNF and see if they have a higher quality image from the from the journals. I don't know. I mean, there's a lot online, but obviously it's not going to be complete. But they might have a higher quality image.
A lot of images, we were looking at images, are advertising.
Yeah.
Which is also, I would argue, highly relevant, you know, in terms of the cultural imagination.
Highly relevant? I don't know, it's about being losing weight.
I would say, I used a lot of those advertisements to track down who people were, because they'll show up in news reports, and I don't know who they are, and if at any point they advertise their services, you can pull up some of those oh, that's what that Pitaloo brothers did. They were lumber importers.
Okay, maybe highly is overstating.
That gets to the scope question. Should advertisements be included?
Yes.
Or should they be coded as something else and segmented out?
I love advertising.
Hmm?
Was advertising in this journal?
Mm-hmm.
But also aimed at schools.
Yeah.
What year are you looking at?
What was it? 19?
It wasn't aimed at schools,
it was
given the
to
blessing of the Ministry of Education.
I can't see this.
I think I'm, because I'm looking at 1890 something and there's no advertisements. So
this,
I mean, that's
19 something, but I can't read the date.
That's the introduction is something that happens, right?
Yeah.
I think.
So do you know anything about the readers' demographics?
I don't have any information on that, no. I mean, other than...
Thousands and thousands.
Do you know about
history? According to what they claim,
yeah.
Right? I mean, that's the circulation problem is always so hard to get to, because you get to how many prints there were, but...
You have that, though.
I don't have that,
no. Okay.
I don't even know where I would get that from, because this is a long-defunct journal, and I haven't... I mean, those would be in whatever archives of the company that...
Mm-hmm.
made it, but I haven't seen that anywhere, tracked it down, but I could try to.
I mean, it might be something that if Colonial Libraries had a subscription to, maybe able to track that.
No.
Yeah, that's a good question. See if, or see if they had any, like, promotional, they had their own, like, we have this readership. They say it in their own journals themselves, but something a little more concrete.
So
on a potential purchaser.
In Living with Machines, one of the things that we're looking at is distribution geography, and when you don't have information about that, you can look at where the advertisers are, because the advertisers are only going to pay to advertise in a market for someone who can access whatever they're doing, and unless it's a kind of... I'm guessing that people don't want to ship things around the world in the 19th century, but I could be wrong. There's some kind of proximity relationship between advertiser and readership, like for any kind of domestic.
Oh, but that's why the weight loss and the series.
The school is a conflict.
Yeah, I don't know, but it would be really interesting also if that were not the case, because that would be very a kind of changing commercial practice.
Yeah, I'm not sure that the weight loss would be... I mean, the late 19th century was the focus on physical fitness, the creation of Boy Scouts and all kinds of light groups. The French were the leaders of creating the Olympics to show off how strong you... I mean, they were super concerned about natalism and building up the strength to stand up against the Germans, so...
Yeah.
It's not entirely incompatible, but
that's,
that would be an interesting question.
Which is
yesterday. Yeah. So maybe we should ask the kind of looming scope question. What should the scope of a project be like, be for this? Like, if we were to think about, maybe on two levels, if we had all of the resources in the world, what should we do? And then we had the amount of resources normally available to an academic, what would be absolutely essential?
For the money is no object, the suggestion earlier of having comparative texts of the travelogues, but also local newspapers, so focusing on a particular colonial location and having a comparison of local reporting would be super valuable to get at that. Us trying to interrogate discourses from the margins and highlight the experience and representation of the unnamed and demonym kind of named people.
And then we'll probably focus on the quality of the text, go back to the resource, the sources, the original microfilm, the original journal, to have better quality illustrations and scans.
That's another question that I open up to everyone else. What, if you were going to focus on a place?
Yeah, I would say if we have the money, we should be ambitious.
Well, just to be clear, we don't have to. But if we had to.
Yeah, I said if. So, coming from a post-colonial point of view, it would be really interesting also, maybe I'm getting ahead, if we can also get the voices of colonized people, because we are talking about the French, what they said about themselves, about the empire. How about the people being colonized? And I know that would be extremely, that would be challenging to get those voices, but we should try.
Are they texts available?
You know, I spent, I don't know how many years I spent in those archives to try to get. Sometimes you will get letters written by these people. I know it's extremely difficult to get. But we should try to dig deeper in order to get their voices, to see how they see the empire, how they respond to the coming of the French in their countries. So again, it's not easy, but at least we need to try.
And one thing that we've also discussed is that a goal of this project is that someone in a represented place in the present could engage with this visual material and one, maintain engagement, two, not be offended, and three, feel involved. And so from my background working in a journalism school, there's a tradition of participatory journalism where you have people contribute to reporting, and that is in terms of including voices. That would be, if we had no logistical and financial constraints, it would be great to collect present day impressions, because it's a really good representational tool, and also feedback loop for us, that if there are blind spots that we've noticed, we can potentially iterate and correct those, and then the findings of that benefits other DH projects with other marginalized voices.
But a lot of it gets back to the breadth versus depth problem. Do we, you know, one perhaps midway point would be to choose one location to try to get like a history from below and have that be showcased as like a case study against this larger backdrop that we've done. But then there's problems with that too, because why'd you pick this place versus that place? There's linguistic barriers.
We always make choices.
Yeah.
So, maybe other people would disagree with us, but at least we have to contrast.
Well, you've got the perfect starting point on your map.
Yeah.
Just choose one of those points and say, look, that's the one.
Yeah.
I start with. And that's mentioned in the journal. Mm-hmm. Use any of them.
Yeah. And because of Chris's interest in the French Caribbean,
That would probably be where I would pick, because that's where I know.
I feel like there's such a lot of efforts around digitization in Haiti with like 19th century Haitian material, that there must be, you know, like it's so hard to get funding to digitize that I don't think you want to necessarily yet go down that route as the core work that you're doing. So figuring out what other people are literally doing right now to digitize those materials, endangered collections, you know, that's happening in different places. It's worth talking to the BNF and the archives, because they may be doing, you know, relevant work there, the archives in places like Haiti. But I wouldn't focus your energy on digitization unless, you know, some leprechaun hops up and says they want to give you digitation money.
Most grants
really
they
hard.
Apply to are like, we'll fund everything but digitization.
Exactly, exactly. So I think
they want us to do that.
Yeah,
you want to make friends with librarians who are already doing that, and then agree to do more when they see how awesome your work is.
We did have that very unusual experience recently on a different project. We talked to people holding a particular archive, and then found out 18 months after we talked to them that they just got really excited by the project and digitized everything.
Yeah.
So we don't need to include that in the grant anymore.
Yeah.
But I think I was imagining, based off what Charles was saying, is having maybe a case study written from not a digital humanities perspective at all, but from the traditional history from below sort of perspective, trying to get at those voices and somehow couple that with the digital humanities work, which is maybe when we get to user interface design and stuff, how would you even go about doing that? I mean, something that the Monroe Art Today project attempts. And there's positives and negatives to the way Studio did it, but
have you given thought at all as to the growth of this and whether or not it would be collaborative, and if there is a library or a special archive or a special collections that has maybe some of the material that does it's more representative of those underrepresented voices?
Yeah.
And if they were able to, if they had the resources and the time and just the desire, like the wonderful Nevada Historical Society did, to contribute, I mean, what would that look like if they wanted to say, like, we could contribute, but they would need to be, you know, certain parameters in place, because obviously you want to do an equal comparison, things like that. I don't know.
I would love for it to be. I mean, that's part of the hope of this workshop, is finding out, networking, who we need to talk to, what would we ask? I mean, that's a big one. If you're going to the French archives, you need to have your ducks in a row, like, this is what I need from you, this is what I'm providing, this is, because if you just send them, you know, I need this, and you don't have, especially with the French bureaucracy, if you don't have the backing of, like, this is what I'm bringing to the table, it doesn't go far.
And Katie's made a great start on that in the Google Doc of starting to identify people and resources. So if names come to mind, or archives, or resources, tools, projects you've previously worked on that might be relevant that aren't necessarily, you know, something to bring up conversationally, please add them to the Google Doc so that we have a collective record of those. Yeah, David.
So on the question about whether images are in scope here, I think so if this project is about geography, and if you have maps available, I don't know if you can ignore them. I wouldn't see that as a problem for computer vision, though, because I don't think it's going to work very well for photo illustrations or these historical photographs. But if the number of maps you have is in the hundreds or low thousands, then you could see that as being a human problem.
Yeah.
Right. One where you have people analytically look at those maps and do something empirical with them.
Yeah. Or just like some really basic similarity clustering can be done in the same way that, like, looking at woodblock illustrations on early printed books is being explored semi-automatically to find where, you know, woodblocks are being reused across printings of books. You might be able to do something like that with maps, just to find out where the outliers are, or, you know, how long things go before they change, or if there's gradual change. Just really basic, you know, like low-hanging fruit with those maps that people can look at.
Yeah.
Well, here's, I guess, another related to the scope question maybe we'll probably be mulling over for the next 2 days. Where do we draw the line between a computerized solution and a traditional scholarship solution, and maybe how do we, how might we marry the two? I mean, we've already kind of raised this of maybe doing a traditional narrative case study on one of the points that's in this wider network of the kind of named entity recognition or recognized locations. But, you know, a lot of the digital humanities projects I've seen have been all quantified computational or kind of more strictly narrative driven. Is there a space, and how would something like that be designed that does both? And how do you make it clear that I chose these 100 or 1,000 maps out of the